Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest edition of the ALS Association podcast. My name is Tony Heil, the Director of Communications and Public Policy here at the ALS Association Greater Philadelphia Chapter. Each episode of our podcast includes stories from people with ALS, advocates, walk team leaders, sponsors, supporters, and of course, people who are experts in the disease, like ALS researchers and caregivers. And today, we're really pleased to bring to you one of those experts who works here at our Penn Clinic and has been working on this issue for a long time, longer than me. Her name is Kelly Almacy, and we're going to have a really good conversation about the state of ALS research, questions you may have thought about for a long time, and hopefully dispelling some myths or misconceptions about how research is done. As always, if you want to get involved in the fight against ALS locally, you can go to www.alsphiladelphia.org. We have many Walk to Defeat ALS events coming up in the next few weeks and months, so you can join one of those at www.gpcwalktodefeatals.org. That's for GPC for Greater Philadelphia Chapter. And you can follow us on all social media channels at ALS Philadelphia. So, as I said, our guest today is Kelly Almacy, and hopefully she's a lot smarter than me on the issue of ALS research. So, Kelly, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
So, Kelly, before we go into a detail about ALS, give me a little bit about your background and why you're an ALS researcher, what you do here at the clinic involving this.
So my background is all neurology. I was a second degree student. I went back to school when I was 30 to be a nurse. I worked down at HUP for 17 years, the University of Penn, in the neuro ICU. So my nursing experience is all acute care nursing experience. I decided when my daughter was a senior in high school to make a change of career as far as the kind of nursing I was going to do. And I already knew Dr. Ellman from her being a resident up at HUP. And I knew some of the clinic team here because they also work at the University of Penn. And I'd heard about this clinic for a really long time. And Amy, who used to be the dietitian here, just talked so highly of it. So I saw the job posted and I asked if they thought I would be a good fit. And I had a ton to learn because I had no research background whatsoever, although I know neurology like I know nothing else. And so I decided to take this job just for something completely different, to learn something new. And the learning curve was probably about a year, but it was a great move. I really like it here.
Well, I assume that having a nursing background actually helps a lot because you know how to be a caregiver, you know how to get the answers out of people. Being a nurse encompasses so much, so being able to communicate as a nurse probably helps you be an effective research person for this issue.
Yeah, I felt like it made that interaction with the patient in the clinic so much easier, being a nurse and already knowing how to deal with patients at the worst time of their life. I worked in an ICU, so they're emotional times, and it's emotional here when a patient gets an ALS diagnosis. So I really felt like that part of it was seamless, and the research part just was really just educating myself and really learning about the disease and how research in ALS worked. So
that's a really important background. And like you said, it's great being able to be at this ALS treatment center at Penn because there's so many experts here that you can call upon. And as you were talking about before we started this, the patients themselves often have a lot of really good background in terms of understanding science and the disease too. So that helps the whole cause overall. So what's your background then in terms of what do you do as a person here to facilitate research? Like, how does that work?
So I wear multiple hats here. The research part of it is just facilitating research at clinic. I try to approach all our patients at their clinic visits and at least introduce myself, explain what my role is, and kind of fish out from them if they have interest in research, so that I know where to focus my efforts towards. Some patients have a knee-jerk reaction about research right out of the gate. Some patients are suspicious of research. Some patients just are all in, you know, what can I do? I want to do everything. So I kind of try to fish that out right out of the gate. And then I go from there.
And as a nurse, that's part of your job. Then your background is being able to lessen those suspicions and allay those fears that people can have.
Yeah. that's a big part of it here. A lot of people think that everybody wants to participate in research, but across the whole country, all kinds of research, patients typically don't take part in research. Mm-hmm. We need patients to take part in research, and that's especially true in ALS research. So I do that. I talk to patients during their clinic visit. I kind of introduce what we have going on here as far as clinical trial research, also whatever research that we're partaking in as far as basic science research in partnership with the CNDR up at the University of Penn. That's kind of like genetic research, that kind of stuff, blood samples, mm-hmm. things like that. And then I just kind of let them kind of lead the way about what they want to participate in. Most patients want to do something if it's not too out of the box for them and it doesn't require too much of them. I would say maybe 20% approach me about clinical trial type of research. Everyone asks about stem cell research. Mm-hmm. I would say 80% of the patients at a regular clinic will ask about something about stem cell research.
And do people ask about stem cell research because it's really the best hope, or is it more because it's just so in the media? And on that note, do people get caught up in things that are in the media more than maybe some other projects could be useful?
Yeah, for sure. I think
not that it's a bad thing.
It's a great thing. And I think a lot of research is going that way. Patients just want it now. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of misconception about where we're really at and how close we really are, mm-hmm. as far as being able to offer that as a treatment. Patients have a misconception that it's already a treatment. And research is not treatment. It's experiment. Mm-hmm. So there is a learning curve while we get there.
And it's my understanding from talking to some others that with stem cells, you have to get the right kind of cell, you have to put it in the right place. So we're not talking simple things. We're mm-hmm. talking neurocells and your spine and your brain, yeah. and everything. That's not something you could just like put together in the kitchen.
And like we kind of talked before this about what the biggest misconceptions about research is. And I think that's one of the biggest misconceptions is people think that it's like an experiment in high school. You know, you think about something, you figure out how you're going to prove it or disprove it, and you crunch the data, and voila, we have an answer.
And takes like a month.
Yeah, and it's so much more complicated than that, especially mm-hmm. because of ALS, because ALS is so many different things. No two patients look the same. We don't have a model to test it on that has been reliable in the past. I mean, we've used mouse models, and they look great, and then when we do the actual research on them, the effect isn't what we think it's going to be. Mm-hmm. So there's just so many variables that it's so much more complicated than that. It's not just, okay, we have stem cells, we'll test them. We have an answer. The patient can have them. Sometimes we don't even have the ways to measure if the tests are working because we don't have the biomarkers, the things to look at to see if it's working or not, even completely identified.
Mm-hmm. So, and I'm sure that there's different trials. You're looking for different kinds of biomarkers mm-hmm. too. So, and I'm not an expert in any of this really, but like I'm just saying, you know, if you had one test, well, we know we should look for if their hair stops growing mm-hmm. or something, and then this one if their eyes or if their vision gets better or worse. Like it's not always the same thing you're looking for, which makes it even more complicated.
Mm-hmm. Right now, the best thing that we have to follow patients in, say, a drug trial is their FRS score. And that's this little questionnaire that we ask about how they're doing things at home, mm-hmm. eating, sleeping, walking, that kind of thing, dressing. And I mean, that it's a great measurement tool. But if you think about what it really is, like that's the way we're measuring if a drug is working right now, mm-hmm. By a questionnaire. So until we come up with something, things that are more hard and fast and science related, it makes it difficult.
Does that kind of questionnaire then make it more likely or lead to placebo effect more? Because I imagine if you told me you're on this trial and maybe like, oh, I think I feel a little better here. Mm-hmm. Like that can happen.
It is a little more subjective because we're asking right. the patient, you know, How do you think your swallowing is? Has your speech changed? How is it turning from side to side in bed? Adjusting your covers, and cutting food, using an eating utensil. They're the things that we're asking the patient to measure. So, of course, there is there's some wiggle room there, so, as far as placebo effect. Like, maybe they do think they're swallowing better. Or, we can only rely on us asking the questions in the same way and them giving them the chance to answer them, comparing to how they were before.
Is that might mean why it's more important that the tests take the trials take a longer time, because I know most people come to the clinic, they come every 3 months or so, right? 3 months, maybe 6 months.
Yeah.
And oftentimes in that period, you see a big difference in their, what they're doing, whether they're walking or speaking or swallowing.
Yeah, you can. With some patients, you can see a big difference. With some patients, you won't see any difference in that period of time. So you do. The trials need to go at least a year or 18 months so we can measure. We have to have something to measure to know if the drug is working or it's not working.
And then you need a big enough population that you can measure. Let's say you have Steve who has ALS and you have Paul who has ALS, and they're maybe similar, but you have to be able to see, well, this person's degenerating and this, like, you have to have comparison points too at the same time, right?
Yeah, because so. It looks, the disease looks different in, you know, if you go out to clinic and you look at 18 patients, no two of them are going to look exactly the same. Their progression rates are going to be different. So we kind of just gather all this data and then we crunch the data and we see what it says. But given that the population is so varied, it's hard to come up with a statistically significant number that says, yes, this is working.
So when you're trying to get a population for a trial, do you try and, in your job, to get a varied population of people and say, you know, Dr. Smith, you're doing is doing a trial and I need people who, I need women and men and people of different ages and backgrounds?
The goal is for, just in research as a whole, is to get the most varied population that you can get. It's hard with ALS because it typically affects men more than women. So, and, you know, Caucasian men more than African American men, just by the statistics of it, it's hard to get a varied population. I've been here almost, 4 years. I've only had 2 women take part in a clinical trial here. They're just either, I approach men and women equally. I approach Caucasian and African American and Latinos all equally. But typically I have Caucasian men in my trials. That's just the way the numbers bear out, because they're affected more than others. So, but you do, you want as, you know, a varied a population as you can get.
And is that, and it, I guess it's harder to get that population because different people can be suspicious or have family members or whatnot.
Yeah, there's definitely some cultural biases about research that I've experienced, and rightfully so, based on how certain populations have been treated with research done to them over years, especially African Americans. There were lots of issues with, you know,
many years ago.
Yeah, many years ago with research. So there are some cultural biases, but I think just based on how you present yourself and the reputation our clinic has, I think those biases are easy to overcome. It really is just about the patient themselves, if they are interested in research or not.
So I know that you've been involved in advocacy. You came down to Washington, D.C. with us last year, and you're coming again this year, which is great. And one of the things we advocate for is the ALS registry, which will help researchers find a population by looking and you know, finding out who has ALS and the numbers and everything. Is that something that helps someone like you and the people you're working with, that kind of tool?
That's actually something. So the registry itself is something I was introduced to at advocacy, and I had heard about it here, but not a ton about it here. And then I started to notice that when I would talk to patients about it, if they were registered in the National Registry or not, there was a ton of confusion with patients if they were registered or not. They would come to clinic and they registered, but they didn't realize they were registering for the chapter itself. And they mistakenly thought they were in the, that made sure they were in the registry. So I went on the registry itself to see if there was any information I could give patients in clinic. And there is a volunteer advocacy program through the registry, and I became part of that. So basically now in clinic, when patients first come to clinic, I talk to them about the registry. And across the board, 90% of the time, patients are confused if they've registered into the registry or just for the chapter itself. So I give them that information here. And, you know, it's voluntary, absolutely. But the basic science research is coming out of the registry itself. Mm-hmm. The research into, you know, populations of patients and exposures to chemicals and, you know, areas of the country, that kind of research is done through the registry. That's not stuff that we typically do in the clinic.
But that can give you some direction.
I'm sure
you do a lot of reading.
I do.
And now that you mention it, though, there's confusion, which is understandable. Mm-hmm. You say, yeah. Are you registered, Tony? Like, in what way? Did I register my card? Or register this? Or that? But so if we're getting information that's helpful now through the registry with those hiccups, mm-hmm. then that's got to be hopeful for where we can go, mm-hmm. right? For what we can
get
later.
Yeah, I think just like letting them know that it's absolutely totally understandable that there is confusion. They get this devastating diagnosis. And so whenever something like that happens, you process probably about 10% of what's told to you. So mm-hmm. it makes total sense. That's why I think it's a great idea to revisit it. And I usually revisit it with patients a few times. And I basically just give them a handout and send it home with them and say, you know, read this over. And if you have any questions, call me. And then I kind of try to follow up with people to see if they've decided to register, if they have any questions about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think the National Registry is really important, if nothing else, to show, you know, the government, what the real numbers are. I don't think we really have the hard, fast numbers of how many people have ALS because there's been no way to track them.
And what kinds of people?
Yeah, like what kind and where and, you know, how young, how old, male, female, mm-hmm. you know. That kind of information is has come out of the registry, like the first reports. So I think it is really important for, if there's one thing a patient can do is, if you don't want to give them all your personal information, just tell them who you are and where you live and if you're a man or woman and that you have ALS. Just giving that information is really important.
Yeah, well, that's important that we have an ability at the clinic and at the ALS Association to direct people to that kind mm-hmm. of research. And that's what we do. We talk about the chapter that we have a three-pronged approach with advocacy, patient services, and research. But clearly, those all blend because mm-hmm. they're coming to do patients' care, they get involved in research, and then hopefully from research they get involved and we're able to provide better kind of treatments too.
Yeah, that's definitely the lines all. We say that in clinic all the time. It's like we all kind of end up talking about each other's jobs mm-hmm. Just because there's no just clearly divisible line about what each of us does. So we all end up wearing a bunch of different hats. And that's why we meet at the end of clinic and kind of talk about making sure each patient's getting what they need.
Yeah, and I noticed that, you know, that a lot of people from this clinic and from other clinics, they get involved in advocacy too, mm-hmm. like yourself. So the whole thing gets meshed into mm-hmm. one. You know, all those primary colors and those secondary colors in terms of all it's mixed.
Well, you can't meet these patients and not want to advocate for them.
Yeah.
It's just, I think it just comes, even if ALS wasn't your passion when you started, mm-hmm. which for me, it wasn't, I really didn't know that much about it. It's an accidental thing that it kind of becomes something that you're passionate about, but you can't meet these patients and what they go through and what their families endure and not want to advocate for them.
Yeah. And I think that's something that is another misconception that I feel about research and researchers is when you hear research or you read something, it's always so dry mm-hmm. a lot of the time. And people think that, oh, you're meeting with someone and they're just patient X or they're person 1, 2, 3, 4. And that's just the way you have to write it, mm-hmm. right? And so they don't realize that you become connected to these families and it becomes personal to everyone involved.
I think that, and I think the doctors here, Mary Kelly, they'll tell you, you get more connected with your research patients than you do anyone else. I have stuff from my research patients, the cards they send me, and you see them all the time. You are a witness to their disease process. You can't not be connected in their life. It's just a byproduct of it. So,
And I know, like I said, that people get involved in research because they contact me and in my role, and they say, I want to get involved, I'm the nurse here, or, you know, with someone that just started within a few weeks saying, I want to try and do more, which you don't get that in a lot of other jobs, necessarily. You know, not that other people aren't good, but just the power of that disease makes a difference.
Yeah, for sure.
So you've been doing this with ALS for 4 years now. Have you seen some positive change? Are there things that we know now that we didn't even just 4 years ago?
Yeah, for sure. There's been a lot of like genetic type things, genes that have been identified both for sporadic and familial ALS. Also the use of patient-derived stem cells is something that's, you know, I'm sure that it existed before I started here, but they're really talking about it now. And basically that's just the process of having a model to test the drugs on. Before, drugs were always tested on a mouse model or sometimes insects or things like that. Now they're actually able to derive stem cells from the patients, ALS patients themselves, and test new treatments on those cells instead, and so we know if they're working on those cells or not, on the motor neurons themselves or not. That's like, that's amazing technology, and that's really just been the last couple of years that it's really
like
out there.
It's
a huge game changer.
Because then you could take a drug that you think could work and put it at, or some sort of treatment, put it towards that, without having the side effects of, you know, maybe it causes worse things, and
seeing the changes in the petri dish itself, whereas, you know, a lot of the drug trials that have flopped in the last few years, they were tested on poor predictive models. So they were using this mouse model and using the drugs on that mouse model, everything looked great, 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 great. And then they actually give it to humans and the trial's a bust. And because the model that it was tested on wasn't a good predictive model. So that's the biggest crux of the problem with ALS research up until this time. So having better predictive models is going to give us better information at the end.
Well, and you brought up a good point that I just wrote down, that there have been a lot of tests that fail, but there's not necessarily a bad test, right? Because if a trial fails, then now the next group knows that that's something not to do, right? Mm-hmm. So every trial, whether it succeeds, which is what we want, or fails, leads to important knowledge, right?
Oh, for sure. There's all kinds of information. We don't just get all this information and then the drug doesn't work, so it just gets thrown out the window. Mm-hmm. We get lots of information that's valuable that we can still use going forward for other drugs, for that drug. Sometimes a drug won't work on the whole population, but they can look at little subpopulations that the drug was used on, and there's a suggestion that it might work on a subpopulation, like maybe patients with just limb onset or maybe patients with just bulbar onset. So there's always something good that comes out of it. It's not the result that patients wanted, is to have a drug that's widely available, but there's still good information coming out of it.
So then when a person with ALS gets involved in a trial and it succeeds, well, we haven't had the success of the game-changing drug yet, but if they have... if they go and then the drug trial finds out it doesn't work for whatever reason, they should still feel hopeful and good that they help progress the science, even if it feels frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, there's always good information being gleaned from whatever data that we're collecting. The other part of it is that patients that are involved in clinical drug research do better. It's statistically proven they do better than patients that don't. Whether it's the placebo effect of having hope or that they just get better care because they get to see a nurse every single month. So there's always somebody keyed into what's going on in their disease process to address it immediately when it happens. It's proven that across the board, those patients do better.
And that's probably in almost any disease.
It's any disease, but it's particularly true in ALS because they're going to come. Some trials, they'll see me every week.
Mm-hmm.
So if you know, last week they're not having trouble falling and this week they are, it gets addressed immediately. It doesn't take till they come to clinic in 3 months. Mm-hmm. So
that reminds me of my grandmother who had Parkinson's. and a lot of similarities. And I don't know that she was necessarily involved in any trials. She was involved in some experimental science, which ended up being really great. This was 15 years ago. But what was able to happen for her was a really positive effect, because it's such a devastating disease to live with. Mm-hmm. And I think that having that purpose makes a big difference, mm-hmm. made it a big difference to her. Like, she was looking forward to things that she would be doing.
Yeah, I think that is part of it. There might be a little bit of an emotional hit of just having, like, you know, the biggest thing I struggled with when I started to do research was, as a nurse in the acute care setting, you're giving all the time. And I really struggled with feeling like I was taking from the patients in that research mode. But over the course of time, I've realized that I am giving something. Mm-hmm. I'm not just taking from them. And they tell me that I'm giving them something, that I do keep in touch with them. I do make sure they get not just research, but they do get emotional support and things like that, because that comes just naturally from my nursing side.
Yeah. And that's a really valuable thing, like I said, about having that, the nurses around, you know, people that Nurses Week is coming up, mm-hmm. and everything like that, and just the appreciation for what nurses at all levels can do to kind of bring people together. So one thing you also brought up that, two things. One, you talked about how now we have more knowledge of the genes for both sporadic and familial. Mm-hmm. I think that creates a lot of confusion for people, and it did for me when I first heard it, because it sounds like, to me, well, if there's a genetic thing, then it should always be a familial, right?
Yeah, so, I think that's a big confusion.
So what does that mean? Because sometimes it's the same gene, right? Like, you can have the sporadic form of ALS, mm-hmm. but you have, I don't know, the SOD1 or mm-hmm. C9. A lot of people might not know what those things are. But so how does that work, that it's sporadic but genetic?
So a small part of ALS is familial, which is, patients think, genetic. So, and it's passed from family member to family member to family member. But there are genes that can affect patients that have sporadic ALS that have not, it's a mutation. So it hasn't happened in before that, but with this specific patient, the mutation happens. And so for that specific patient, then it's genetic. It's a gene that's causing it, but it's not a familial type of disease. And C9 is one of those things that they found that can affect both in a familial way, and also can affect sporadic patients as well. It's a really small portion, a really small percentage of patients, but it's still there. And I think the genetic part, even for me, is one of the most confusing parts about this mm-hmm. disease. That's why it's great that we have a genetic counselor here. And I pretty much defer to her, to Beth Wood, because that's her background and she's brilliant at it. So there are some things I can intelligently discuss with patients, but as soon as I feel like I'm getting in that gray area, even the doctors, I mean, both our doctors here are amazing, but when it gets to that gray area, we make sure that Beth gets involved. And our patients here are really lucky that they have access to that. Mm-hmm. 'Cause it fills a really big hole for patients, just knowing if that's a problem for them or not. Because that's a lot of these patients come in, they don't know what sporadic ALS is.
Right.
They
Why would you?
They worry about their kids. And right. So having someone who can sit down with them and saying the chances that this is a problem for you or your kids is this percent. Mm-hmm. It's huge benefit to them.
Yeah, I know. I got involved because my grandfather had ALS, and my dad, no one else in my family does, but there's concern. It obviously was concerned, mm-hmm. He got it when he was older. Will my dad have it? Well, there's no one else in the family that we can point to that had those symptoms, but who knows from back then. So yeah. It's good to be able to get that kind of background. So we know that there's a lot of different genes, mm-hmm. and we don't need to get in those kind of specifics right now, but yes. So there's a lot of different genes. There's sporadic, there's familial, and then there's the kind of different onsets, you said. Mm-hmm. And it's not just limb and bulbar, because it could be different if it's the different limb, too, in terms mm-hmm. of how that person is.
Yeah.
So that means that the population is extremely varied beyond just the demographics that people understand.
Yeah, it's a huge research challenge, because patients can have unilateral limb onset or just their legs can be involved, or just their arms can be involved, or they can just have bulbar, or they can have a combination of all of it. So what is classified as one disease, you know, can end up looking like 10 different diseases. Mm-hmm. And so to find a single treatment to fix all those, that's been the challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why a lot of the research now, even though they'll do a clinical drug trial and everyone will be included, the new wave is to really start to look at subsets of patients. So to look at how the drug is affecting limb onset patients that are on Relutech and off Relutech, and then bulbar patients that are on Relutech and off Relutech, and to see if the drugs that they're testing are affecting maybe these people differently than it's affecting these people.
So then maybe in the future, maybe next year or tomorrow, we don't have the drug that helps everybody, but mm-hmm. we're able to say, for whatever reason, this treatment works for people with limb onset ALS, and this treatment will work for you, but it doesn't work for here, so we're still to keep working. Mm-hmm. So the research may have to continue because we can find one treatment, and one treatment for if it helps even one or two people, is still great.
Exactly. That's true.
So that's something that people should look to and just be realistic in terms of understanding where that progress is.
Mm-hmm.
So what do, how does the clinic and like the whole team help get that done? You have your job, and what do the other people do to help facilitate the process?
As far as the research?
Yeah.
Dr. Ellman and Dr. McCluskey have a really big part in it. And I think that is, I'm sure other physicians do it as well, but I just know how well our physicians do it here.
Mm-hmm.
They know I can't see 18 patients in a day and talk about research. So they try to fish out from patients when they see them too. A lot of times patients will just say right out of the gate, so what's going on? Can I talk to somebody?
Mm-hmm.
But they're both really good about fishing out if patients want to be involved, if they have an interest, and then getting me to talk to them. So that's hugely helpful because I can't see everyone. And, you know, we went to start this today and I was held up for about 30 minutes talking to a family about stem cells. And so figure that out through the course of a day. If I spend 30 to 40 minutes talking,
right,
you know, to a family, I can't see everyone. So they're really great about that. Plus all the other people in clinic too.
Mm-hmm.
We all just kind of help each other out. So other members of the clinic do the same thing as well, as far as, you know, getting me in touch with the people that I have to see.
Well, I'm sure that the social workers who work for the ALS Association, mm-hmm. when they're in touch with people, even at an event or something like that, and they ask, and they can facilitate you at any time, really.
Yeah, for sure.
Not that you have to be on call 24 hours a day, but you can get a lot of information from the many clinic staff at any time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's important. And so how many trials are you often working with, like different kinds of research thing? And I don't necessarily know if it's always clinical trials, but how many things might be going on at one time that you can help facilitate?
There's probably 4 or 5 things going on at one time.
Mm-hmm.
That's not always going to be drug research, clinical trial research.
Mm-hmm.
Sponsors don't like you to have a bunch of trials going on at the same time. And when they look at centers and do feasibility studies about where they're going to offer a trial, they want to make sure you're not going to have 4 or 5 trials going on at the same time because they compete mm-hmm. with each other.
It diminishes the population that can
exactly.
do that trial, right?
And with ALS subjects being a premium, you know, sponsors want to make sure you only have 1 or 2 or 3 going on at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, 2 is really like optimal.
Right.
And that's usually what we'll have, 1 or 2 going on, or we'll have 1 and then it'll overlap with the second one that's going to start.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's optimal just to recruit into the trial and to meet your numbers so that the trial can get the numbers that it needs to get the data that you need
mm-hmm.
to see if a drug works or not. So I do think like 1 or 2 is great. And, you know, some people will be like, you mean you're a researcher and you only have 1 or 2 things going on, like really, what do you do? But there's so many facets to this job that, you know,
oh yeah, definitely.
Your time is filled. And even having like, I only really have 1 going on right now, but I have 12 patients in it. So they all have to come monthly, and I keep up with them in between. And, you know, there's plenty to keep you busy. And I, you know, like you said, I do advocacy. I do lots of other things. Plus, I help Dr. McCluskey and Dr. Ullman with anything they do, too, with data collection and things like that for any other research that they're doing that might not have anything to do with, like, actually being in contact with the actual patients.
Great.
I mean, stuff that's done in the background.
I mean, if I make a small error in a communication role, it's like, well, I missed the letter A, or I made a spelling mistake, and that's not the end of the world. Whereas you have to go over stuff over and over again to make sure it's accurate, because you want them to succeed.
Yeah.
So, and then I'm sure that in addition to that, you're also reading up on what's the next thing and working for the next trials that come, or follow up from the ones that have ended. So there's even more there going on.
There's a lot of regulatory stuff behind the scenes with keeping the sponsor updated with all the information that you've collected, and then keeping the IRB, which is the regulatory bureau that makes sure we do everything the way we're supposed to do it. We have to keep them in the loop. And we just have to, anything that changes, any new information that comes, if they change the consent, the regulatory is the first person that you need to let know about that. So I have to communicate with them constantly. That's the biggest part of getting a trial up and running. And it can take months of back and forth with the regulatory people to get a consent done and to get them the information that they need so that they'll even say we can do it.
I'm sure if you're doing a trial too, because there's often many trials going on across the country, you want to make sure that it's not necessarily duplicative of something else happening, right? That, you know, you want to make sure that the science that's happening with your patients that you care about is worthwhile. It's not like, well, someone else is already doing that. It's, you know, they already have a bigger population. So what makes this trial special, right?
Well, luckily, that kind of works itself out. Lots of times, you know, we've even had some ideas about doing stuff here. And then when we get out there and we try to get funding, or we look into it, we see that other people have already started doing that. And research money is so competitive that it's duplicating things, especially with ALS, really isn't done, because the research dollars are so important. We want to spend them, you know, expeditiously. So there's not a lot of duplication of research done.
That's important.
Once you start asking questions, you find out, oh, somebody else is doing it. There's no point in duplicating a process that some other great ALS researcher is already doing.
That's important to know, because when we go to Washington, we talk about the ALS research project, the Department of Defense, which you've worked on. And, you know, they're, congressmen are always saying, well, is this duplicating research out there? And like, well, that's not, like, we would never want to do that.
No.
So that's important for them to know, because as a general layperson, you might, why would you think otherwise, right? So how, you said people want to donate or sponsor or get involved in trials or get involved in research. There's a lot of ways that people can help. How can people get involved in helping progress research?
So
whether they're a person with ALS or not.
Yeah, if you're a person that has ALS, I think a really small thing you can do is get yourself onto the National Registry. It takes about 5 minutes. You don't have to give them a ton of your personal information. I think that's a really great thing. You can also consider being in one of the biobanks and just either donating urine or blood or tissue. And that's pretty, usually that can be a one-stop deal. Do it once and be done. There are ones that do it serially over time that you can get involved in. I would encourage people, if you have interest in research, to go on the ALSconsortium.org. That is the Northeast Consortium's website, and they have a great patient-driven website that kind of leads patients into what's recruiting and what's out there. I think our patients are educated, and I think you should stay educated. You should know what's going on and what's out there and ask questions. And that's what I'm here for. I tell patients all the time, like, I'm not just here if you want to do a clinical trial. If you have a question, if you hear something in the news, if you see something, pick up the phone, email me. That's what my role is. I'm here to make sure you understand what's going on. And if you have questions and I don't have the answer, to find the answer for you. So that's another way, just keeping yourself educated.
Yeah.
As far as friends and family, I think that when they hear about something, they should educate themselves. Because I have a lot of patients, they'll come and they'll be like, yeah, you know, my buddy was online and he saw about this drug and he says it's the newest cure. And I think you should educate yourself before you pass that on mm-hmm. to your friend.
No matter what it is.
Whatever. Yeah. Yeah, because
you might be online and say like, oh, I saw that if you drink a cup of hot pepper, it's going to, it's all.
Yeah. Educate yourself before you take, you know, every lame brain thing that you see on the internet to your friend that has ALS. Because patients do. They'll sit here and they'll say, you know, I know they're well-meaning, but it gets frustrating
mm-hmm.
to be brought something or emailed something every month, every week. So as a friend, you know, your intentions are great, but you should research on your own what the likelihood of that being mm-hmm. something successful before you pass it on to your family member
or your friend. Yeah, and get in touch with one of the researchers.
Mm-hmm. Do the same thing that I'm asking our patients to do. Like, get in touch with me. Ask mm-hmm. me. Let me find out for you.
Mm-hmm. And then they can continue to support financially by going through the ALS Association or going through Penn or other ways so they can continue to support trials going on, I'm sure, right?
Fundraising is always a big thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's never going to be enough money for ALS research, and we've gotten cut from Department of Defense. I mean, every year it drops just a little bit. So if the Ice Bucket Challenge was amazing last year.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a one-time thing. That's not going to happen all the time. So, yeah, if you have some money and you you're interested in research, then, you know, every little bit counts. $5, $20, whatever mm-hmm. it is. Like,
yeah, and I was talking to another researcher on the podcast a while ago and said that, you know, $20, a few hundred dollars buys a rat.
Mm-hmm.
Or X amount of dollars buys this thing, and you need mm-hmm. a lot of them to be successful. Yep, so exactly.
Not that many people out there have the $1 million that they can give. But, you know, my niece is getting married in June, and instead of spending a couple $100 on favors to give out at her wedding, my brother and my niece and my sister-in-law decided to take that money and to donate it to the Greater Philadelphia chapter. They lost a friend.
Mm.
To ALS this year, somebody that was really big with the Greater ALS chapter, and to honor him, they decided to do that. That's just something small but huge.
Yeah.
Because
not only that, when you do an event like that, especially a personal one, mm-hmm. but whether it's that or a walk or something like that, you're raising awareness to your whole community.
And they're going to give out little favors at mm-hmm. the wedding that say this, you know, this was done in lieu of giving you, you know, a bottle of wine or a candle or whatever at the wedding, and it's in honor of this person.
Yeah, I would rather have that than a lot of other things I get at weddings.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been to a lot of weddings, and we rank them.
Yeah.
So that would rank high.
I know, it would rank really high. I thought it was a beautiful idea, and it's a way to honor Roger Kirk.
Yeah.
And we all loved him, so.
Yeah, and like you said, it's, you know, those people that touch everybody in the mm-hmm. world. And I had a feeling that's who you were talking about when you mentioned that, too. On a positive note, though, what should people feel excited about or positive about moving forward in the next? We don't, obviously, we're not like, well, tomorrow we're all working the next thing. But, you know, why should people feel hopeful now?
I think, well, we touched on it a little bit, and I think the patient-derived pluripotent stem cell thing,
mm-hmm.
which I think that's really, really exciting. If patients don't really know what that is and it sounds really complicated, the ALS Association has some webinars on the site that kind of go into the science behind mm-hmm. it that are really, I can't explain the technology of it to you, but the doctors who are actually going to do it have a webinar that explains it.
Which is another way that people can get involved. Simple way, the ALS Association has weekly webinars.
Oh, for sure. There's so much information, much valuable information that's out there
mm-hmm.
That it's just sitting there. Right there on the computer,
yeah.
and it's free. So I think that is right up there with like the what's really, really exciting going mm-hmm. on right now, because it's going to give us models to test the drugs on that are reliable, and that has been a struggle with ALS research. So if I had to pick one thing, like that would be it. The Ice Bucket Challenge is another thing that just gave us all a lot of hope, because that opened up some some areas of research that were just kind of stalled because the money wasn't there. Mm-hmm. And so now the money's there, and lots of these little projects that kind of were just sitting on the shelf can get funded now. So people want to know where did the money go? Well, you're going to see all these little things that there wasn't money for getting done.
Right.
And every little bit counts. So.
Yeah, well, like I said, my grandfather, he passed away from ALS in 2007, so that was 8 years ago this week that we're recording, and the things that exist now, like the pluripotent stem cell testing and the neurons that we know about now didn't exist then, mm-hmm. and if they did then, he still would have passed away because it was still so quick and close, but it's so much hopeful than it was just 8 years ago, and that's exciting. And I think part of the reason it's exciting is because of people like you and the people here at our Penn Clinic that are facilitating this research and making it happen. So, well, thank you, Kelly. I really appreciate you sharing your expertise with us.
Sure.
If people want to follow along with us on email and social media, and we'll make sure if you have questions, we can follow up with Kelly later. Mm-hmm. And you will always be here for answers. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Look forward to fighting ALS together.